Sarah, welcome back. We're going to dive in today and we're going to talk about what everyone's talking about, but we're going to do it better. Hookless rims.
Well, you're going to answer some of my questions about it as well, because I have loads. But this basically came to the forefront over the last couple of days because Thomas de Gendt had a big crash at the UAE tour. So this controversy has been getting a lot of airtime, a lot of paragraphs written in publications about hookless, tubeless rims, and should they be in the World Tour Peloton, and are they safe? So Vittoria Tyres, they are the creators of this system. They officially blame a rock, that Thomas de Gendt hit a rock. So they think it's the rock's fault that this happened and it's not the hookless rims. They basically say that that's what happened. And the Italian brand basically says that, yes, they're going to have a look into it, but it was something to do with impact that causes this accident to happen. Zip, who are the manufacturers of the wheels, they came out with a statement and they said that obviously they take the performance and safety of its products very seriously and they're going to be doing a full review. Now, Adam Hansen, who is the CPA president, and he's very outspoken. We've had him on the show. I think he's an absolutely fantastic advocate for all of the cyclists within the pro peloton. He came out and, as per usual, pulled no punches, shoots straight from the hip, does Adam, and he basically said in an interview with Velo that this crash is why the CPA are 100% against hookless rims. And he said that tyres should not come off a rim, which I agree with. When you look at the images of Thomas de Gendt's bike, he said his tyre came off, the safety foam inside got caught in the fork, and that locks up the front wheel. So that's Adam Hansen's point of view. And I have to say, I kind of agree.
Yeah. Okay. So Adam Hansen is saying he's 100% against hookless rims. Like, that's a sensationalist story that's just not born out of the facts. Did he hit a rock? Maybe. The chances he hit a rock are definitely chances that are greater than zero.
Well, Thomas de Gendt actually did come out on his social media and he just put something on a tweet saying, what did I hit, or what did I just hit, or something like that. So he obviously felt like he hit something.
Very plausible that he did hit something. So, you know, maybe he did hit something. And then if he did hit something, that maybe explains the tire coming off. The hookless rim maybe is a different debate. Maybe it's a connected debate. It's definitely brought it more into focus. The wheels he was using, and Ronan McLaughlin on Escape Podcast, who Sarah was away with last week, he geeked out on this debate to a level that just...
Only Ronan can.
Yeah, I can't do that level of geekism. But the wheels he was using was a Zip 353 NSW and a 28 mil Vittoria Corsa Pro. The team have said as much with that. Now, the ISO standards on tyre compatibility mean that he shouldn't have been using a tyre any narrower than a 29 millimeter. So he was using a 28, he should have been using a 29, and that's because the hookless tyre on the rims has a 25 millimeter internal rim. So that's on the team. He used the wrong tyre with the rim. So I don't think that's on... Adam Hansen can't say we're 100% against hookless tyres. The team have set them up wrong. The team need to hold their hands up and say, if it indeed wasn't the rock, that the responsibility falls on them. Now, where I do have a big problem with the hookless system at the moment is there's a max pressure per square inch on hookless of 73 PSI. And a variance of 10% can cause failure in the hook rim system. So quick maths, that's 7.3 PSI, which sounds like, okay, grand, just pump your tires up to within 7.3 PSI. But there's a 10 PSI margin for error in home track pumps. So means you actually can't get this right.
You can't get it right.
So hookless has a long, long way to go. But the industry seems to have decided it wants hookless for ease of manufacturing, much in the same way the industry decided they want disc brakes. We don't care what everyone wants. We want disc brakes. Now everyone's forced to have disc brakes. You haven't got an alternative to that. I don't think we're going to have an alternative to hookless systems. It's coming. It's coming hard. It's coming fast. This is the worst it's ever going to be. It's going to get better and better. So yeah, I think for better or worse, it's here.
And if we take like 100 steps back and I ask a stupid question, what is hookless? I mean, hookless is what I'm riding on my bike at the moment, right?
Today's show sponsor is Pillar. Well, we're all familiar with the importance of electrolytes and carbohydrates.
and their role in our race preparation, Pillar is taking a completely different route. It focuses on micronutrition, ensuring we're ready to perform even before we hit the start line. It's all about promoting a good night's sleep, facilitating effective recovery, and replenishing those crucial micronutrients so you can perform at your very, very best. I've been running my own personal little experiment over the past month, and I've been incorporating Pillar's triple magnesium supplement into my evening routine. I take it about 30 minutes before bed, and the results I've seen are absolutely remarkable. The improvement in sleep quality, about 10% I've seen. I've been tracking my sleep with my Whoop device, and the results are there in absolute black and white. I've given this to friends, they've tested it, and they've all experienced the same results. I wake up feeling refreshed, having had a deep restorative sleep, so I'm ready to attack work, training, and life the next day. But don't just take my word for it. The data from your fitness tracker will tell you the story. So if you're ready to elevate your performance and your sleep quality like me, just go ahead and give Pillar a try. Head to pillarperformance.shop and use the code ROADMAN on your local website for 15% off your first order. If you're watching this in the US, head over to thefeed.com/pillar and use the code ROADMAN for 15% off that first order as well. Now let's get back to the show.
No, you're not riding a hookless system. So it's the, if you think about the wall of your wheel, it's the internal bit of your wall where hooks are on. It's the lip,
yeah,
exactly.
The lip.
It's the lip. So the lip is quite hard to manufacture. So this is an ease of manufacturing. There is apparently some performance role and resistance gains to it as well. But
how
it's an ease of manufacturing.
How does the tire stay on the wheel? Because I remember you telling me stories about years ago before hooked that you were like gluing them on and things like that. Obviously, it's not that, we're not
totally
going back to that kind of system.
No, it's a totally different system. It's a totally different system. That's tubeless back in the day, which were brilliant as well. But look, they developed a tire, they developed a rim technology where it stays on. The engineering of it, I don't particularly know how they've engineered it, but it doesn't need to be hooked under like previous editions, because that's apparently logistically very difficult to do in manufacturing, because you need to, you know, make that cavity and then somehow indent it. So I talked to a wheel manufacturer about it, and he said it's just much, much easier to make hookless rims. So
okay,
they're here,
they're coming. They're on the way. Okay, in other news in racing, there was a little bit of a funny story that you and I heard from somebody when we were in Girona. I can't remember who was saying it to me, but this story has seemed to have grown legs, a beard, and I think balls.
Because it happened ages ago.
It did. It happened way back, way, way back last year in July, actually. So recently, in the last week or two, UCI have come out and sanctioned Seniska Cycling after their mechanic fraudulently posed as a rider. So this is a female team, and basically they needed 5 riders to start this race, Argenta Classic, last July. The 5th rider was unavailable because she was sick, so she couldn't attend sign on. So only 4 of the riders were available. So the 4 team riders were forced to go along with this lie, and they dressed up one of the team mechanics in a kit and a face mask, and they sent her to sign on as the 5th rider. So as I said, this story has grown legs, because news out there, out and about, was that they dressed up a male mechanic.
Is that true?
That is not true. It was a female mechanic that went, put on the kit and the face mask and posed as
the 5th
rider.
But what if they dressed
up
a male mechanic who had the she, her pronouns? It'd still be the same, would it?
That's like a whole... Well, the UCI, I think they've got pretty strict rules about that at the moment. They've finally got in line with some of the other World Federation rules. I don't think that would have washed either.
This reminds me of Orica Green Edge Backstage Pass. They had a videographer called Dan Jones, who I've had on the podcast. He's hilarious. He's the co-host of Socially Distanced podcast with World Tour rider George Bennett and former World Tour rider Sam Bewley. And a few years ago, they dressed Dan Jones up as a rider for sign-on, but just for a gag, not because they needed to make a minimum or anything like that. But they followed him with a camera crew. So it's like, you know, the third week of a Grand Tour, the guys are more gaunt than they usually are. And then you see Dan Jones, he's a nice way to say it, he's poured into his kit.
He's kind of, there's lots to love. Dan has a lot to love.
He's shimmying through the security and they're kind of looking at him going, what? Is he a World Tour rider? Because he has the kit, he has the bike, he's the helmet, the glasses, everything. It's brilliant. Should find that if it's still on YouTube. Backstage Pass is phenomenal. Oh,
that was absolutely brilliant. The thing about this one is that the UCI has actually fined the team manager, Danny Van Hoat. So fined a large sum, apparently, and banned from any cycling activity until the end of 2025.
Good enough for him.
Yeah, some people are saying it's a little bit too harsh, but yeah, you can't just be putting anyone in kit and having them masquerade as a, you know, a Conti team member. Okay, well, we crack into the questions. This is from at Saint Rider 123. Anthony and Sarah, what do you think of the proposed 20 miles per hour restrictions on time trials? Now, this is, I looked into this a little bit, and this is new guidance basically by one of the British standards and the Cycling Time Trials like Association in the UK. They announced basically that all the riders taking part in time trials on UK roads, they're now going to need to slow down when they're riding through 20 mile per hour zones. This has gotten a lot of backlash.
It's a nothing story, isn't it? Like, there's always been speed restrictions in areas where races have gone through it. It's, you know, they've started a race in an area and said, okay, the race is neutralized for the first 6 kilometers until we get out of this speed restricted area. The idea that it's for time trials, well, they're just not going to start the time trial in that course. Like, the time trial is going to start at the edge of the speed restricted area, not in the middle of it. How could you have a time trial in a speed restricted area? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think that what's happening is time trials are beginning, and then, like, let's say they come through an area near a school, let's say, for 300 metres or for a period of time, a short period of time, and that is a 20 mile per hour zone.
They're just going to have to pick a different course. They can't go through that area, because otherwise how would you run the time trial?
Well, that's why they're asking. It's like, do we change course? Do we slow down? Is this going to kill time trials?
We can't slow down. Like,
I don't know. I've never done a time trial.
I've seen people talking about this, and I just don't get. It's so obvious that the course can't go through the speed restricted area that I don't even get what the debate is. Like, how would you figure out if somebody rode 22 mile an hour instead of 20 mile an hour through the speed restricted area? So that the results are all sure. We may as well not have got out of bed this morning because the results aren't accurate.
Okay.
Am I missing something on that, or is it like totally bizarre?
No, I don't know. I think that this is just basically this per hour restriction, and they don't know what to do with it or how to use these.
Or else,
new
like, what else could you do? I think maybe you say the whole section's neutralized. Remember, like, we raced in Santa Val and it was broken into segments. So you have segment one and you take a time going into the start of the, where it's like basically there's a finish line where that slowdown happens, and then there's a new start line where it ends, segments.
What a catch. Roadman, you know how serious I take my goal setting, and I know how serious you take it too. So whether you're chasing fitness or lifestyle goals, and you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It means I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for the takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle of this banana into my backpack when I'm heading into the city, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods that don't support my training goals. It's handy, it's nutritious, it's 22 grams of protein. It's perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs. Huel Ready to Drink has over 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every bottle, making sure you get 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from amazing natural ingredients like sunflower seed, coconut, and more. And the best part, 8 mouth-watering flavors. My favorite's the banana. That's what's in my backpack at the moment. You can get Huel direct to your home by going to huel.com/roadman. That's Huel, huel.com/roadman.
That's a really, really good idea. I love that idea. They're now afraid, though, people in the UK, I've seen a lot of chatter on Reddit about this, that they're now going to restrict in 30 mile per hour zones. So all of the time trials in the UK, they're afraid, are going to have to happen on dual carriageways and big roads where the traffic count is actually bigger. So a lot of the smaller secondary and third roads, right roads, have a lower traffic count. So they don't think that this, you know, it should be an issue. But when you start moving to bigger roads with higher you know, miles per hour or ability to go faster, the traffic count is actually higher.
Yeah, do you know what, the TT lads love that?
They do, yeah.
Yeah, because you're getting, like, I remember the fastest course in Ireland used to be Wood Green. Someone tragically died up there. I don't know what happened in the incident, but it was a dual carriageway and used to love racing up there because you're getting the draft of all the cars going past. So literally every time a car went past, you were like going, edging out of your lane to try and get into a slipstream briefly and then back in, back out, back in. Obviously not a great idea, but the speeds that people were, or the times people were doing on those courses were so much faster.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a watch this space with the time trials in the UK. It would be a pity if time trials start to, I mean, there's a lot of obstacles get into time trialing because of the expense of getting bikes and all of the aero equipment if you want to be really, really good at it. So it will be sad to see if this actually puts more obstacles to people running events and putting on races. So yeah, let's watch where this goes over the next couple of months. Okay, the next question. Anthony, what are the top couple of dirtiest tactics in cycling over the year that you've seen, obviously excluding doping or motor doping? I guess I'm talking more around tactics and strategies.
There's a couple. In 1975 on Puy de Dôme, Eddie Merckx was kidney punched by a fan going up and impaired his performance significantly for the rest of the race. I'm not sure if he broke a rib in it, but it was a blatant assault. Another one was Anquetil in 1964. He claimed that, I don't know if this was ever validated, but he claimed that his rivals poisoned them in the race.
Like, I would well believe this. I've done a couple of podcasts about the origins of cycling and the origins of the Tour de France and all of the Grand Tours. And not so much the teams or the riders themselves, but the fans, literally fanatics, people who are completely obsessed with riding, the riders, the being winners, you know, cycling, all that thing. The fans would take it upon themselves to, you know, destroy the opposition's bikes, poison their food, punch them, throw things at them, put nails on the ground, all of that kind of stuff. All of those dirty tactics. So
Aqua Blue got their bus burnt out at the Vuelta a España a few years ago. But there was another Sean Kelly one. I can't quite remember the story. I think it could be in Sean Kelly's autobiography. He had the leader's red jersey in the Vuelta a España, and a break went up the road and the chalkboard that shows you the numbers of who was in the break, this is before earpieces, the Spanish contender to Kelly, I can't remember his name, he was second or third on GC, he snuck into the break, but whoever was doing the chalkboard omitted that he was in the break. So he went up the road and got minutes. Kelly was like looking around thinking, hey, where the hell is your man? I haven't seen him in ages, but it says he's not in the break. So he found out super late that he was in the break. And I think Kelly lost the jersey, as far as I remember that story, in that move. But there's been duplicitous stuff going on in cycling, yeah, as long as there's been cycling.
That's very fishy. God, that is a really, because it's including, it's about around an Irishman losing time on GC, I have to say I'm absolutely disgusted that that happened. Okay, next question. So I took the plunge and got a whoop and I'm enjoying it. I've listened to your podcast and one in particular that Sarah did on HRV, and I feel like I'm kind of filled in on that. But what exactly is resting heart rate an indicator of? And why is this number so important, or is it?
I don't think any of the numbers are super important on their own. That's for what I'm getting chatting to, you know, like said Dan Plews, who's an expert on heart rate variability, and I've one coming up podcast in a couple of weeks, which is for me one of the best conversations I've had with a physiologist, Dr. Stephen Saylor. And we talk about this where there's no one metric. Like Whoop loves to give you a readiness score. It's honestly a load of nonsense. Your readiness needs to be first and foremost determined by how you feel. Like you get up out of bed in the morning, do you feel like training? Like when I got back from Girona last week, like I just didn't feel like training. I'd done too much, and you need to listen to your body and stop using data as like a proxy to tell you how you feel, because you need to tune into actually how you feel. Having said that, I think you can look at some of those metrics, and if a lot of them are pointing in a single direction and you're kind of on the fence about how you feel, you can use that maybe to sway the narrative a little bit. I think resting heart rate is one of those that I would look for, not small changes, but if there's like a 10%, you'll establish a baseline in your resting heart rate. Like, I don't know, for me, it's like 38 to 42 is like my resting heart rate. And if I have a deviation of around 10% in my resting heart rate, that's like one of the warning lights flashing on. And then if my heart rate variability is down as well, that's another warning light flashing on. And then I ultimately go to, how do I feel? And that's the ultimate barometer of if I'm going to train, if I'm going to take a rest day, or if I'm going to, you know, push hard.
As you can see from the background, I'm over in beautiful, sunny Girona, but this isn't my reality. Normally, I'm time-crunched in Dublin, need to make the most of every single hour. That's why I heavily rely on my Watt bike. I love it, and I recommend it to you because it just works. There's no 10-minute setup, no unfolding legs, banging my shins off stuff, or wrestling to take a back greasy wheel off. Just jump on, and it works. It's also compatible with all the major e-gaming platforms, connects instantly. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I couldn't recommend it any higher. It's the last indoor trainer you're ever going to need. Head on over to whatbike.com and use the code ROADMAN10. That's ROADMAN, T-E-N, and that's going to knock you 10% off your whatbike.
Yeah, I think with HRV, it's more of an instant number that will be affected by a poor sleep, or if you've had like a couple of glasses of wine the night before. Whereas, so the next morning you will see that your HRV number has probably significantly dropped, whereas your resting heart rate will take a few days for, if something, if you're coming down with a cold, if you're very fatigued, if you're getting sick, you will see your resting heart rate go down over a slower period of time. That's my understanding of the difference between HRV. That's more of like an acute way of looking at your health system overall, and the resting heart rate is more of like an overall, more kind of longer term view on how your body is resisting illnesses and fatigue and things like that.
Yeah, I think if your resting heart rate is significantly down for a couple of days, it's almost too late to take that action. You need to be looking at heart rate variability as that leading indicator.
Yeah.
But again, the main thing is just, how are you feeling?
Yeah, exactly. Get to know your body and understand your body. We're like huge advocates here of, before, you know, I'll wake up in the morning and I'll say to Anthony, how did you sleep? And he kind of always jokes and says, oh, I have to check my app, I don't know. And that's not the way to do it. We don't advocate that at all. It's like, actually get to understand how your body feels on a day-to-day basis. These numbers are brilliant, brilliant tools, but really try and understand your body first and foremost. Okay, what are the pros and cons of disc brakes versus rim brakes? I know this seems like a very basic question, but anytime I look it up online, I'm shown an article that is clearly biased one way or the other. Anthony, settle it for me. I'm going to buy a new bike soon and I'm going to use your advice. Disc brakes, how do I take care of them? Are they easy to maintain? Is there weight consideration, stopping power, noisy, etc.? So it sounds to me like this listener has kind of, you know, made his mind up about disc brakes, and his hand has probably been a little bit forced by the industry as well. But can you explain, because this is a question that a lot of people do have, and when you go online, onto YouTube, anything, you will, it's very hard to get a balanced answer about which is better.
Well, look, I hate to break it to him, but you can't buy rim brakes.
Well, you could buy like a second-hand bike
maybe, yeah. But he said he's going to the bike shop, I think. He's going to buy a new bike soon. Maybe it's new to him, and that's what he means. Yeah, if you're going secondhand, you can buy it, but you got to think now that manufacturers aren't going to be bringing out the new stuff in rim brakes anymore. So I don't think SRAM make a SRAM Red with rim brakes anymore. Dura-Ace, I think, still make a rim brake top of the line DI2, but that's not going to happen next time around. It's rim brakes in the industry, or sorry, it's disc brakes in the industry now, full stop. There's no other game in town. Why are they better? Depends on the type of riding you're doing. If you ride in the rain and you're using carbon rims and you like stopping, then disc brakes are going to be for you. If you love flying down mountain descents in carbon brakes and you like that thrill or adrenaline of pulling the brakes and nothing happens, then rim brakes could possibly be for you. But that disc brakes are just
Why are people like so passionate about rim brakes and really try to hold off on getting disc brakes, or, you know, take, you know, accepting that rim disc brakes are a thing? You know, it really does feel like people are, you know, very much skewed on either side.
Well, like, you probably don't need the amount of stopping power that a disc brake gives you on most instances in the road, with that exception of racing in the wet on carbon rims. But if you're racing in the wet, you could flick to aluminium rims and you still do have a good bit of stopping. You need them on mountain bike for sure. You need them on gravel bikes for sure, because you're going down super technical steep descents where you need that stopping power. I think people are fighting it for a couple of reasons. Maybe they have rim brakes. Maybe they have a bunch of wheels like we do in the attic, like about 15 sets of wheels that are rim based, And now it's like, well, what am I going to do with all them? Like, some people spent $3,500 on a set of lightweight wheels the year before disc brakes came out. And now they're like, okay, I had the best set of wheels in the game. Now I don't have any set of wheels. The big thing, if you're working on your own bike, is maintenance. Like, it's difficult to maintain disc brakes. You need to know how to bleed brakes, change pads. Changing pads on, you know, a rim brake, it's, you could do that at the traffic lights when it's red. You could stick a new set of pads in. So they're super easy to work on. You can pull a cable out, bang a new cable in, you know, really fast and easy to work on. But bikes are going that way where it's, they're not easy to work on anymore. It's like the same way you drop your car into the garage. You need a computer technician, not a mechanic now. You need to plug your bike into a laptop to update the firmware now when you go into the bike shop. So it's going that way, and we don't have much say in it. But if you're a traditionalist, you could still use rim brakes for a long, long time if you're not too precious on following trends.
So he said, Anthony, settle it for me. So judging by that, you are saying to him to just embrace disc brakes.
It depends on what he's doing though. Like, if he's, you know, I could see a scenario where I only use rim brakes when I stopped racing, where I got a nice bike, maybe a custom made steel bike, like a Mariposa or a 51. And I had a lovely set of rim brakes and nice wheels, and I only brought the bike out to the coffee shop on sunny days. That's definitely a scenario. Depends on the type of riding he's doing, but 99% chance he should be going with discs.
Yeah, I will say, when you do move over to discs, just be careful. There's a lot of stopping power there. You can get booked off your bike pretty easily if you're not careful. You don't have to grab handfuls of brake like you're used to with the rims. So
you were locking it up last week, weren't you?
Yeah, I was locking it up. So I have disc on my gravel bike, but it's a different type of riding. Like, I don't know, you're a bit more, you know, there's a lot more friction when you're stopping anyway. But yeah, I was on disc on a road bike in some pretty slippy conditions. And yeah, I was getting, my back wheel was locking up.
She added in slippy conditions there.
Managed to keep it upright, but yeah, a few kind of squeaky bum moments out there.
Before we finish up, Sarah, I want to give, because I'm not sure if we gave one last week, a My Whoosh session of the week, because people have been hounding me for a session they should do. So get on over to My Whoosh. 60 minutes is the session. And during that session, I want you to do 4 8-minute efforts. So we're coming closer to race season, and I see a lot of people doing threshold efforts. Threshold efforts are, you know, they're great, but they don't mimic the demands of a race that much. We never really ride into a climb at, okay, we're all going to ride threshold. You don't ride away from anyone at threshold. It's so easy for people to follow. So this is a front-loaded effort. So you're imagining you're fighting for position into the base of a climb, or you're trying to get separation. So for the 8 minutes, it's going to be 1 minute full gas effort and then into 7 minutes of threshold. Then you can ride easy for 4 or 5 minutes and then repeat it. So you're going to do 4 of those 8-minute front-loaded efforts. It's a spicy enough session, but it's all done in 60 minutes. So you can't complain too much about it.
That sounds hard. You had me doing 4 by 1 minute full gas efforts. Kilos. In Girona up Els Angels a couple of weeks ago. And I was seeing stars. I was so tired after them. I actually realized about 90 seconds into my descent that I was on the wrong side of the road.
Good stuff. You
shouldn't
have told me
that. Tired I was.
Sarah, thank you for chatting.
Good to be back.
If you like this video and you want to hear more from myself and Sarah, click up here, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel. That's over here.